Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This week on The Wheelhouse. Political violence. Political violence across the globe. And political violence in the United States. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. It's the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. It's a brutal time in politics. Vladimir Putin's political rival in Russia, Alexei Navalny, has died. Russian authorities say Navalny died of natural causes, but his death does come with suspicion, particularly since he was once poisoned, yet survived. The American government blames Putin for Navalny's death. So does Navalny's family. His death is one of the latest examples of political violence globally. But political violence doesn't just happen, quote, far away. It actually hits close to home. Right here in the good old U.S. of A., let's not forget the January 6th insurrection. Today on The Wheelhouse, we're going to talk about politically motivated violence across seas, yes, but also in the United States, and how it poses a threat to the health of our democracy. And stay tuned. We're going to talk to a good friend of mine, Bria Lloyd, in a little bit about the Bridgeport election and another local election in Bridgeport in the Park City. But to start us off, I'm joined by Katie Reisner, Senior Counsel for United States United Democracy Center. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming on this morning from D.C. We appreciate having you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kevin Boyle, William Smith Mason Professor of American History at Northwestern University. Thank you for joining us today, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Frankie.
And thank you for calling in this morning. And I want to remind folks that if they're paying attention to this talk today, they want to participate, give us a call, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677, if you want to join in the conversation. Katie, to start out this discussion, we want to know what we mean by political violence, if you can just break that down for our listeners.
Thank you so much. And it's a great question. Political violence is a term that on its own can really refer to a lot of different things. I think it makes sense to sort of start with a really broad definition. So I think of political violence as meaning any acts that are intended to change how and whether people are able to participate in civic life in civic spaces. So this includes stuff like hate crimes. Hate crimes are at base, you know, targeting people on the basis of their identity to try to make sure that they can't participate in public life, that they are not part of our civic fabric. So that would be what I would call the broadest definition. At my organization, at States United Democracy Center, we focus on political violence that specifically targets elections, democracy, and democratic processes. So this really is a focus on violence aimed at voters, at election officials, and at the peaceful transfer of power. It includes acts of violence, but also threats, intimidation, harassment, massive disruption to election processes. And preventing all of these is hugely important for our work to protect democracy.
Can you help me understand its scale? Like how many acts of political violence might there be in a given year, or at least whether or not this is something that might be trending upward?
Absolutely. There are a few important, I think, indicators to look at for, you know, the rise and fall of this phenomenon. You know, one thing is important to note that political violence is not new in the United States. Mm-hmm. There have been plenty of very violent periods in our history where violence has been targeted against voters trying to really eject them from participation in our civic fabric. But today, political violence looks like a few different things. It is threats against election officials is one of the maybe most acute places this is showing up. Right now, one in three election officials are scared in their jobs. We are seeing election officials retire from this really, really important work because they simply don't want to put themselves and their families through it. One thing that is just really so heartbreaking to see is the targeting of people's families, people's kids. We know folks who've had to relocate their families, relocate in order to stay safe. So threats against election officials is a huge part of this. Threats against elected officials and their families is a huge place where we are seeing a surge. You know, you can look at the swatting attempts, and we can talk about swatting, but the attempts to really harm elected officials, the U.S. Capitol Police reports investigating record numbers of threats against members of Congress, you know, events like the attack on Paul Pelosi at his home. This would absolutely be considered an act of political violence. Threats against elected officials are really at a significant high. You know, the threats to the election processes themselves. This is another place that we're tracking. And as we head into the 2024 elections, something that folks across the country are really, really planning for how to address and really stay vigilant about.
Assuming that this recent act against Alexei Navalny and his death was really caused by Russian government. Assuming that that's the case, talk to us about that act of political violence and help us understand whether or not that's the ultimate act, first of all, and whether or not this is something that can inspire something similar here in the United States.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, something that I like to remember is that, you know, if we take a step back, the reason we have democracy, the reason that we have elections is to solve our political, it is a means of preventing political violence. The reason we have elections is to ensure that the next folks to take power are able to do so peacefully. That's the whole point. And so when you have the murder of a political opponent, that is what a failure of democracy is. You know, when you have violence on the system, when you have violence as the means of deciding who is in power, that means that democracy is failing. And so, you know, the Navalny's death should to us here in the United States serve as a really stark and horribly tragic reminder of where, you know, where things can go if we don't really all remain really vigilant about protecting our democratic institutions. It should really be a very clarifying, you know, call to us that protecting our democracy is absolutely imperative.
And I imagine why that we'll see a lot of commentary from Navalny's family, and we'll see some of those clips from that documentary to kind of stoke hope in Russia from whoever is opposed to the government because of this act. It's always meant to maybe snuff out democracy and snuff out hope. Kevin, as an expert here in history, let's do a little history 101. Is political violence new in the United States? Obviously, we just established with Katie that that's not necessarily the case, but help us understand when we've seen this before.
Oh, it's happened any number of times. So when you bring up, Katie brings up a number of really important points. There's a long history of political violence in the United States. Sometimes that political violence has come from the government itself, the political violence, say, of the wars against Native peoples in the 19th century in the plains. That's political violence coming from above, from the state. The form of political violence that we tend to think of much more broadly comes from below. And as Katie said, it has often been driven by hatred. it's often been driven by fear at its core. There's a sense that runs through the American past. It's not the only part of the American past, but it runs through the American past, that one group or another has decided that another group or another, based on its politics, based on its race, based on gender, based on its religious beliefs, is an inherent threat to the nation. And therefore, it is legitimate for the one group that feels embattled to turn to violence. And that's happened over and over again. We've had outbreaks of racial violence continually in the United States. We've had outbreaks of religious violence. We've had outbreaks from below the horrific lynching frenzies of the early 20th century in the South. That's political violence. So it takes a lot of different forms, but it does have a run through in American history.
So help us distinguish then this era that we're seeing of political violence from the past.
I think there's, again, I think the basis of it is that sense of fear that has always driven, and hatred that has always driven political violence in the United States. But what's really different, what's happened in the last, say, 40 years, are kind of three key changes that have accelerated the level of political violence that bubbles up from below. One of them is the economic dislocations of the last 40 years, this incredibly strong sense of inequality that has become a defining force in American economic life. Another is the really revolutionary change in social media, so that ideas can, and hatreds and fears can circulate at this kind of incomprehensible speed. And then I think the third one, and it's where the top down and the bottom up start to get wrapped together, is the willingness of politicians, Donald Trump being the ultimate example of this at the moment, to play directly on those hatreds and fears, to mobilize them in a way that politicians had started to do certainly in the last 20, 30 years or so, but has now reached a kind of fever pitch. And I think it's through that combination of fear and anger and hatred from below, and then a mobilization from above, that you get the sort of political violence that Katie was describing so effectively.
Katie, can we now kind of hone in on disinformation and misinformation and how this kind of contributes to the issue? And we sort of have this unholy union between Russia and America in terms of operatives when we talk about misinformation. Can you just help us understand how this can kind of create some political violence as well?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, our information ecosystem is hugely important to the decisions that we ultimately decide to take offline, out in the real world. So what we are seeing in the sort of election-related political violence space is, you know, deliberately spread falsehoods and that end up motivating people to go and take action out in the real world. So these, you know, if folks are really believing that an election was stolen, then this is, you know, that's something that can give rise to folks wanting to go out and take matters into their own hands. If folks believe that voting machines are connected to the internet and therefore are getting tampered with and results are getting fabricated, then that's, you know, a motivation to go out and take matters into your own hands. So the information that folks receive, the falsehoods that are spread, both organically and deliberately, these are all really the kind of sort of the origins of everything that we then see out in terms of political violence.
Trying to understand who exactly would feel compelled to engage in political violence, Kevin. So you wrote this article recently that touched on the role that family and friends can play in attracting people to radicalization. What'd you find?
So to me, this is really critical that Katie is absolutely right. I agree with her completely that what happens is that people get wrapped up in this kind of misinformation, the conspiracy world that floats around them now. The tricky part is that lots of people get wrapped up in that world, but they don't act on it. there's lots and lots of people who will just read stuff on the internet, right? And that's as far as their radicalization goes. So the information itself can't explain why people actually act in violent ways. And I think one of the really critical factors is that political violence is driven by ideas, but it's also driven to a really dramatic extent by personal connections. And I'll just give you one example. On January 6th, there have been now over 1,000 people indicted for their participation in the January 6th assault on the Capitol. 25% of them were indicted alongside a family member,
including
or a romantic
two
partner.
Connecticut residents, a mother and daughter.
Oh, it's all over. It is all over. People went to the Capitol with family members, with their husbands, with their wives, with their sons, with their daughters. They went with their boyfriends. They went with their girlfriends. Because what happens, what turns people from ideas to action is the social connections that really drive people's action. You go because your father wants to go. You go because it's a weird kind of date that you're going on.
We're going to hold hands on our way to the Capitol here.
Yeah, and lots of people did. And then if you add in the number of people who came with someone they identified as a friend, that percentage just shoots right up. It's social connections that help to drive people to actually act on the radical ideas that are all around them.
So you mentioned earlier the early 20th century lynchings, and I apologize for bringing this up because it is graphic in nature. But I would imagine something that's weaving political violence together in America in particular is white supremacy. So help us understand how that continues today and how we see the current acts of political violence.
It is absolutely central to much of, not all of, but much of the political violence. That white supremacy has, of course, an ancient history in the United States. There was a point in American history, it turned out to be a brief point, where that white supremacy became utterly and completely marginalized. And then in the last 30 years, it has surged back up in a really extraordinarily terrifying way. And it drives huge amounts of the political violence that we see. And it runs through some of the attacks that Katie was describing on election workers, what happened in Detroit, what happened in Atlanta in the 2020 elections. And it runs through horrific acts like Dylann Roof's attack on Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, which is the most, you know, kind of an explicit example of white supremacy. It's probably the most powerful part of that fear and anger that I was talking about earlier.
And that's the thing. We have such a proud history in America of wanting to participate in civic duty. So it's very interesting and very harrowing when Katie brings up that 1 in 3 of these poll workers are reporting in surveys that they feel that they feel threatened. So Katie, help me in understanding your work here. Well, there's this big election coming up, hearing that election workers are feeling worried about working at the polls this year due to threats of violence. Is this something you're hearing more of, or can you at least give us maybe specific examples? I don't know how far the surveys went, but how maybe we could also prevent this and make people feel more comfortable?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because I do think it's important to, you know, as we talk about the threats of political violence in this country, it's really important to also talk about stories of resilience. It's really important to talk about how we as communities, as concerned citizens, can all really, you know, really, really look to stories of resilience to ensure that we're able to, you know, overcome this really tough chapter in our history. So one way in which we reach out and help election officials is that, you know, we as an organization exist to help provide additional services to these folks. And one of these is we really help them think through the security plans, the physical security plans in place to protect themselves, their staff, their facilities. And really, you know, we're doing that 365 days a year at this point. We are helping folks really kind of do audits internally of like, where are the vulnerabilities here? when the ballots come in from polling places to our central count facility, what path do those ballots take? Where could they potentially be intercepted by protesters who are intent on disrupting this election? Where are election workers going to be sitting out in rooms where perhaps very animated, very angry observers could be coming in and trying to intimidate, harass, threaten the folks who are just trying to count the ballots and get to the close of election day. So we really think through all of those situations. In the past several months, we've seen an alarming trend of swatting. I mentioned this earlier. Swatting is when folks call in hoax calls to emergency services, to 911, and claim that there is some sort of emergency pending at a specific address. So maybe that is an election official's home, maybe that's a poll site or a central count facility. And the claim made by the hoax caller is that there's a shooter there, there's an active shooter there, or there's a bomb threat, or there's a hostage. And the goal of this behavior is to get a SWAT team to come to the scene and perhaps even respond in a very kinetic way with folks with firearms. So the goal is to sow chaos, potentially to result in further problems. So swatting is something we've seen against election officials in recent weeks. It's one example of the kind of thing that election officials are really, you know, making plans and taking seriously and planning against. So we're out here working both with election officials and with law enforcement, because in so many places, given the shape of the threat that we're seeing, there is going to be a law enforcement response. And so, you know, having election officials and law enforcement leaders in deep communication really all year long, essentially, to really make sure that they're sharing information about what threats they are seeing, that they are really examining all the different places where security could be improved, and that they really have a trusted relationship so that if something does take a challenging shape, result in something threatening, challenging, harassing, that they have someone trusted they can call. So all of this has been meaningful. We've seen folks really take really productive action to really increase their resilience in this environment.
Katie Reisner is senior counsel for States United Democracy Center. Kevin Boyle, William Smith Mason Professor of American History at Northwestern University. Kevin, Katie, thank you so much for coming on The Wheelhouse this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate you guys coming on. Thank you so much. And coming up after the break, we're going to own in on one of the most violent moments in recent American history, the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Join the conversation if you'd like, 888-720-9677.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davita Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important, because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We're talking about political violence today, how it's evolved throughout history, who's drawn to violence, and what our country can do to prevent it. Joining me now, one of Connecticut's own, Chris Doyle. He teaches American history at Miss Porter School in Farmington and holds a PhD in history. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Frankie. This is a really timely topic. I appreciate it.
Arkan Fung, director of the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation at the Harvard Kennedy School. Arkan returns to the Wheelhouse. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me back, Frankie.
We appreciate having you. The democracy show we did together was really a highlight, so I appreciate you coming back. I just want to know, I'm going to ask you a first question here, Arkan. We already heard about how political violence is pretty common throughout history and unfortunately something we're still dealing with today. But right now, I got to say, it does feel as tense and scary as I can remember in my life. Are we living through what you would call maybe an especially dangerous moment?
I absolutely think we are. Statistics on that track political violence in the United States show that it's kind of at a high point since 2018, 19, 20, and that's when the data end. And I'm sure that's been increasing in the last couple of years. This is from the Global Terrorism Database. And then just anecdotally, you know, in addition, I absolutely think Katie is right in many, many election officials from secretaries of state on down to county clerks have suffered all kinds of threats. But we're just living in a very, very rough time. So I think you see, you know, the threats and violence certainly against politicians. You know, Steve Scalise on the Republican side was shot, the attack on Paul Pelosi. But then all the way down, I think if you talk to school board members in many school boards in Massachusetts, you'll see that they're getting a lot of harassment and other kinds of things. And also, you know, even my colleagues, professors, you know, the Ivory Tower, we're getting different kinds of attacks on social media also. And I wanted to, I thought Kevin was just great in especially in pointing out the ways in which what the factors that are different now. And one of them is certainly politicians kind of condoning and even encouraging these acts. But there's two additional factors on the leadership side. One is the inability or the unwillingness of some politicians to condemn the kind of violence that I'm sure that they disagree with. But there's kind of no upside. If you're on the center right or right, you'll get sanctioned by leadership, and then probably you'll end up getting a lot of threats to you and your family also. So that's one. And then I wanted to say another factor is a bunch of how we're thinking about political violence, especially in the first segment, is it's kind of organized. Like January 6th, there's the Proud Boys, there's others, there's the Oklahoma City attack on the Murrow Building, organized militias. And that's really important. But social scientists have pointed to another kind of political violence, which they call stochastic violence. And that's comes from the presence of a lot of guns and other weapons in the United States. Some people having mental health issues, some people believing things that aren't really true. And then you have a bad day, you're worked up, you're threatened, you're afraid, and maybe you lash out, even though you're not part of an organization. And part of my worry for the political violence that's out there is normal political discourse among politicians in this polarized age. President Biden saying so-and-so is a huge threat to American democracy. Virginia Fox on the hearing saying somebody teaching this DEI class is standing everything against everything America is for, you know, that's ordinary political speech. That's not kind of incitement. But then given the stochastic pattern out there of a lot of people who are well-armed and some of them with mental health issues, it can set off a kind of political violence in a way that I hadn't really seen in past patterns in America. And to your historical point, I think this is kind of a high recent point in political violence. I think if you go back to the 60s, you'll see similar turmoil, although the dynamics were quite different then.
So just underscoring what you said about people essentially taking up arms or feeling the need to, an October survey said that nearly a quarter of Americans agree that, quote, patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. So I just wanted to use that point to underscore and ask you now, Arkan, are our democratic institutions built to handle the extremism we're seeing right now?
No, they are not. So right now, so one thing that hasn't come out so far is that the fear that Kevin pointed to is actually politically symmetric. So an October NBC poll, 81% of Democrats think that the other party's agenda will destroy America, and 79% of Republicans think that the other party's agenda will destroy America. And then also in polls, both sides, significant members of both parties feel that political violence is justified. So 36% of Republican identifiers think that it's justified sometimes to use violence to advance political goals. But 33% of Democratic identifiers also feel that it is justified to use violence to advance political goals. Now, the actual political violence, the data show, recently has been perpetrated primarily by the far right. Both sides say they're willing to engage. One side has actually been engaging much more than the other side recently.
Chris, we have a presidential election coming up, as we keep mentioning, because it really is important. And regardless of the outcome, we can only hope that the transfer of power, the transition of power, will be peaceful, but it isn't always. Do educators have a responsibility to talk about moments like January 6th with their students? Does education help prevent continued violence? Let's think about History 101. Let's think about civics here a little bit.
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, just listening to Archon and your other guests, imagine if you were one of my students listening to this conversation. My students are bright young women. They're about 15 years old or 16 on average. And I've always thought that history is a great tool for helping us not be surprised by the events that we're living through. And personally, for me, that's one of the reasons I feel I have an obligation to teach the Capitol riot in the context of larger themes in history. You know, Timothy Snyder, the great Yale historian, said, you know, if you don't know history, everything's a surprise. I don't want my students to be surprised by the events that they're living through. They can be shocked by them, but I don't want them to be surprised. And so, you know, we do talk about political violence in class, and I have set up the Capitol riot for them. We're actually just finishing our course in the next few days. And there's different ways into the subject, but yes, I definitely teach this.
And your 15 and 16 year olds are dealing with social media. And as we heard from Kevin Boyle earlier, social media has sort of an adverse impact on this world of political violence and maybe raising its profile a bit. So help us understand social media and the impact it might have on your students.
Well, I think the biggest difference between the way my students see the world and learn about the world and the way I learn about the world and see the world has to do with reading media and journalism and books. Luckily at Porter's, a lot of my students are readers. You know, I come into class and I saw a student reading Dostoevsky before class for pleasure, and I felt confidence and faith in the next generation when I saw that. But most students take in news through social media. So there's no filters on that. You know, there's no fact checking, there's no filters. And it's very easy to get a really distorted view of things. I think part of what I try to do is just get them reading books and get them reading good journalism like The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal. Like that's crucial. I don't think most students realize that there's a difference between different kinds of media. And that's another part of the process in my class.
And I would imagine, too, that being so young and impressionable, too, they have to deal with whatever their parents are dumping on them as well. We talked about that family component.
I'm sure, you know, Archon talked about that and Kevin talked about that. Who your family connections are make a huge difference in what your political outlook will be, especially at that age. You know, I know for a lot of kids, just coming into a history class is a bit of a challenge because they have a quite unique take on the American past and the American story. All the kind of violence politically, historically, that Kevin was talking about the first part of the show, You know, that's all news to a lot of people. And, you know, most of my students have no firsthand experience with violence, thankfully. So to make it seem real to them historically can be a big challenge.
Yeah, I'm taking a mental note about the show. This is probably something that I'm going to share with my friends and family when the November election comes up so they can understand how we impact one another and how our thoughts do and how are there some other issues to pay attention to when you go to the voting place rather than just what you hear on social media or whatever. But you talked about what shapes people and their thoughts. I've been shaped in my life kind of towing the line around politics here and sports, but mostly with politics by what happened in the 2000 presidential election and then what's happened in recent presidential elections as well here. That's kind of shaped my thoughts on democracy here a bit. So I want to play a couple of clips for you all and kind of unpack why these moments are so important for democracy. First up, I want to play something from Hillary Clinton in 2016, right after she lost to Donald Trump.
Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it.
We talked about the year 2000. We remember that contentious election. Here's Al Gore after losing to George W. Bush, Al Gore, the Democrat.
Let there be no doubt. While I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. I accept the finality of this outcome, which will be ratified next Monday in the Electoral College. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
Archon, take me into that last clip in particular here, and maybe think about something that we heard there from Hillary. Why are they making these speeches?
Well, I think Al Gore's concession speech is one of the most moving political speeches in recent memory. And the clip you played, he's saying two things that are very important. The first thing he's saying is, I think I won this election. I think the Supreme Court is wrong. I think the recount in Florida should continue. The difference is 526 votes. And so I think I won. But then the second thing he's saying is, yeah, but it's not my call. It's the Supreme Court's call. They get to decide in our institutional structure, and that's why I'm conceding the election and throwing my support to George Bush, right? And so it's really, really powerful. And I wonder whether anyone, I mean, I think we know, at least based on the 2020 election, that Donald Trump had a different view about that. But I wonder how many Democrats and supporters of Joe Biden would also have a different view. Just replay it, but with the cards flipped. Say it's a really close election.
Before we get to 2020 or 2024, let's consider Hillary Clinton here. Hillary Clinton could have a gripe for potentially winning the nomination, or excuse me, winning the election. She had to contend with Russian misinformation and gerrymandering's only now being somewhat fixed federally. So maybe Hillary had a point here before she conceded on the night of the election, essentially.
Yeah, that's right. And I think she conceded for similar reasons to Al Gore. She's deeply an institutionalist. And I think there are fewer and fewer institutionalists as the fear on both sides really, really grows. Absolutely.
So we're going to play you a different clip now. We're going to hear something that's not a concession speech. This comes from January 6th, 2021.
We're going to walk down and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down. We're going to walk down, anyone you want, but I think right here, we're going to walk down to the Capitol.
Archon, put your headset back on here and give me some play-by-play into what we just heard.
Well, I think the January 6th events and then a bunch of the hearings and things that have come out after January 6th show that there was a very strong effort on the part of Donald Trump and his allies in the White House to really use every legal maneuver and some extra legal maneuvers to see if they could get a different outcome from the election. And so there was the outside pressure from the January 6th, that political violence point. But that kind of goes along with the inside game to call Secretary Raffensperger in Georgia to see if they can get a different slates of electors that favor Donald Trump, despite the popular vote results in several states. This is the memo from John Eastman that lays out a plan for Mike Pence to say, hey, look, when we're doing the counts, we can admit another slate of electors. And if it's a toss-up, then we can go to what's called a contingent election. And if that had happened, Donald Trump would be president right now.
So that's two examples right there that are very key, at least very key to the argument that the January 6th committee made. They said that the group of federal lawmakers said that evidence of Donald Trump's role in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol and riling up protesters, they used that clip as part of evidence. And you just mentioned Brad Raffensperger and what happened in Georgia. One other example of political violence, essentially maybe strong-arming an election official and saying, hey, fellas, what are we going to do here? We need 11,000 votes. Where are my 11,000 votes? That's not an exact quote, but that's paraphrasing. So I just want to open it up here. Let's go to Chris here. What ramifications does this have for the upcoming election, this continued election denial over the last 4 years?
Well, personally, I think that there's probably a high likelihood that we're going to have more misinformation and perhaps more violence. And again, you know, my job isn't to tell my students who to vote for. My job is to use history as a way to kind of make sense of and not be surprised by upcoming events. I tend to use the New York Times documentary film Day of Rage about how Trump supporters stormed the Capitol. And students are really shocked by that. You know, I've had a lot of students watch that and say, gosh, I didn't know it was that violent. I remember the first time I played that video, it was less than a year after the riot took place. And I had a student who's now in the Ivy League saying, man, I didn't know it was like that. And I kind of lost my kind of disinterested persona. And I said, well, it was less than a year ago. Where were you? And, you know, he said, well, we didn't see anything like that. So, you know, the shock of seeing the violence of that event is something that's very disturbing to people, and it should be. And, you know, sometimes that shock kind of wakes people up and gives you a sense that, gee, I need to pay more attention to this.
Chris, if you feel like you can answer this, please do. Have you faced any pressure to not show a video like the Day of Rage in class?
I have not. I have not faced any pressure to censor my teaching. But I think I'm fortunate. You know, if I lived in one of these states where it was against the law to, you know, allow students to feel discomfort, then, and there are many states now that have passed or considered laws where anything that's upsetting to students emotionally or perhaps inducive of guilt in students is grounds for disciplinary action against teaching and even loss of a teaching license. Frankly, I don't think I could teach in one of those states, Frankie. I think history can be disconcerting. And, you know, I feel really badly for my colleagues in those states.
Archon, just about a minute left here in the segment. Just help us understand here about the people working as purveyors of our democracy, poll monitors, all the way up to election officials. Help us understand how this could go the other way, perhaps. I know we're talking about a high likelihood, and we can't be naive that this will get maybe even worse. But how can we maybe turn the corner on this? What recommendations do you have for politicians?
I think it's an all-hands-on-deck effort. To Katie's point, I think the work that her organization and many others are doing to help election officials harden, if you like, voting places and even their offices is really, really important. I was having a conversation with some friends in Madison, and as a result of that conversation, it led them to think about what they could do at the legal level. So they passed, they strengthened a nuisance abatement law to create more penalties for people who threaten or attack public officials, including election workers. So I think we should be looking at all sorts of legal new laws at the local level and at the state level to strengthen these things. And a lot of people are worried about First Amendment concerns. And so we have to, you know, kind of do that dance a little bit. And then the scale of this problem is new. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done to have secretaries and election officials work with attorney generals and law enforcement to figure out how to better protect. And I should say that this is kind of a live debate among the left now, or among different groups on the left. On the one hand, you really want to protect election officials and stem the political violence. On the other hand, one of your biggest tools for doing that is law enforcement. And understandably, out of the movement against mass incarceration and the awakening after George Floyd, many progressives are nervous about more law enforcement. So that's a conundrum that people have to work through.
Archon, you and Chris Doyle here have helped us continue such an amazing conversation we had with Katie Reisner and Kevin Boyle earlier. Archon Fung from the Harvard Kennedy School and Chris Doyle, history teacher at Miss Porter School in Farmington. Thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thanks, Frankie.
Thank you very much, Frankie.
The Wheelhouse continues after this break. We're going to talk about a local election right after these words.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is the Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public. I'm Frankie Graziano. The city of Bridgeport has had not one, not two, not three, but four elections for mayor in 5 months. Park City residents went to the polls yesterday for what should be the fourth and final election. You're never going to hear me talk in absolutes when we talk about Bridgeport and politics, but it comes about 4 months after a judge tossed out the results of Bridgeport's first mayoral primary back in September due to allegations of ballot stuffing. And through it all, the investigative team at Connecticut Public has been there to cover it. I'm going to now welcome to the show for the 11 billionth time to talk about this, investigative reporter at Connecticut Public, Bria Lloyd.
Hey. How are you?
Late night for you, but you still made it for us.
It was a late night, but I am here today.
And thank you so much for coming on. The fourth time residents have had to vote since September. Did you get a sense yesterday of what they felt like going back to the polls and then maybe how many people turned up to vote?
Yeah.
For this fourth time?
I was at Harding High School yesterday, and a voter I spoke with said that, you know, this is the fourth time I've been here. I've been coming here time and time again, and I'm just ready for this to be over. So I think that a lot of voters feel this way. You know, it's been a long election cycle. And it was slow yesterday, but it was also slow in the last race. And so I'm not exactly sure how many voters turned out. I spoke with the registrar's office yesterday, and they'll have updated vote totals probably like today or to sometime this week.
Four times. That person you talked to at Harding, somebody you should probably keep in touch with, because that's somebody that cares about democracy and civics. We just had a civics discussion. While we've been watching this election closely, and of course you have, so too have state election officials.
Yes.
Before the primary, Secretary of State Stephanie Thomas discouraged people from voting via absentee ballot. And this past Monday, a day before the second general, this is the second general, fourth election, whatever, she's telling people to get out to the polls, kind of urging them to get out there. So how's the state been involved at least in this particular election that we had, the fourth one?
Yeah, the state's been keeping a close eye on the city during this whole process. They had election monitors at the town clerk's office. They were making spot calls to absentee ballot applicants and, of course, checking video footage at the ballot box, which we know has been a huge point of, you know, controversy during this whole thing. And so they're really, you know, cracking down and keeping a very close eye on the city during this race.
Yeah. And while the state's been saying one thing or another about whether or not the you know, talking about endorsements, things like that, we have seen in the press, at least, people calling this an embarrassing moment in Bridgeport, having to have four elections. But nonetheless, we did have the four elections. Joe Ganim's the winner. So we think, is it finally over, Bria?
So we think, I mean, as of now, this should be over. His challenger, John Gomes, said this week when we talked to him earlier that he would not be pursuing any more legal action if he lost. And so given that he did lose, I don't know if there would be anything happening next. You know, it's still hard to tell for sure, but it seems like this is it. And Joe Ganim will be mayor again.
Third term, I think, for Joe Ganim out of the, what do you have, six before or something like
that? Yeah, I think this will be his eighth term in total.
Eighth term in total. Okay, good.
Yeah.
So we'll have to watch when that starts. But what I will tell folks is that we at Connecticut Public work for tips, your news tips. The TAP team at ConnecticutPublic.org can be reached at tips@ctpublic.org. Stay tuned to ctpublic.org for outstanding work to come from Bria and my TAP colleagues. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
In studio.
Yeah.
To my left. I appreciate you coming in. Today's show produced by my partner in bringing the politics to the people, Chloe Wynn. Thank you so much. You did a fantastic job today. Technical producer, Kat Pastor. Thank you so much, Kat. And thanks to Local Phone God and terrific Where We Live producer, Katie Pellico, for helping us in studio. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse.